This is the current federal tax developments from the Lascalzo Institute for the week of June the 26th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute and your state society of CPAs. This week, I'm a little bit late because I was returning this weekend from Newark, New Jersey. So those of you who normally pick it up on the weekends, yeah, we're going to be a little bit late getting this posted this week, but we will be there before the 26th. And we are going to look at what happened this week in taxes. Now, I've had a number of things going on this week. You're probably aware that where there was the release of the healthcare bill from the Senate, their version, at least their discussion draft, and we'll briefly discuss that before we get started as to what exactly is going on there. We also had this week a new phishing scheme the IRS warned us about that, interestingly enough, pretends to be a education provider for a professional that needs information. It's kind of interesting how much information they need per this email, but it's phishing for your for information. We'll talk about the a case involved with private letter ruling about S Corporation rentals and when an item is not passive income for the S Corporation excess passive income tax, which is distinct and separate from the 469 net from the section 469 passive income rules we talk about. We're going to talk about a case Chief Counsel advised where it was concluded a corporation was liable for unpaid payroll taxes by their PEO. The IRS began reissuing P-10s this week. We'll briefly discuss that and the IRS's announcement about where we stand on the rest of the issues arising from the Steele case. And we'll also then finally talk about the IRS, a court case where the IRS was found to have miscalculated going concern value for a business that was making an offer in compromise. Well, as I said, I got back from doing some traveling this week, and I was out over in New Jersey, both in Voorhees and over in Iceland, giving courses this past week. So I got back there. The good news about that was I missed the really bad heat in Phoenix this week. Many of you may have heard the temperatures here got up to around 122. That's a little toasty even for Phoenix. So luckily, I was sitting there in New Jersey in a much cooler environment for that period of time. Coming up, I've got a few courses going on here shortly. One of the courses that I have, by the way, Tuesday, if you're not yet, if you hear this early enough and you're in the Tucson area, Tuesday I will be doing an ethics session put on by the Jewish Community Foundation of Southern Arizona. They have a sponsored ethics session with the Arizona Society's course, and we'll be giving that starting at 7:30 in the morning. Interestingly enough, when it gets hot, it turns out that we like to start early, so it'll be 7:30 in the morning there on Tuesday. You can find out information about that on the Jewish Community Foundation of Southern Arizona's website if you're in the Tucson area. Also got a few courses coming up here toward the end of the month. I will be going to Bozeman, Montana here towards the end of the month and have a couple of courses there dealing with various issues, including trust issues, I think are kind of interesting to take a look at. We also have coming up in early August, I'll be in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're talking some there about things like changes of accounting method. That's also kind of a unique and interesting area of the law. One of those things you just don't get into too often. And then when you do, you discover, well, I really need to know a little bit more about this. Finally, I've got coming up the three courses in Phoenix coming up in August on the 9th. We'll talk about fringe benefits. By the way, a topic of discussion there obviously is going to be whatever ends up happening with the healthcare bill, assuming we have some sort of answer by that date as to where we're going to be going with the changes or lack of changes to the Affordable Care Act. We'll discuss that on August the 9th, along with all the other fringe benefits, because by the way, it's not just medical care for fringe benefits. We'll also talk on August 10th about preparing Form 1041. We're going to talk about trust, how you work there. We'll have a discussion, too, in that course about the issues related to the Uniform Principal and Income Act of Arizona. We'll discuss that in that course. And finally, on August the 11th, we have our 8-hour session on ethics and quality control and tax practice. That course actually does qualify 4 hours of it for ethics in the state of Arizona. And the rest of it really is a tax-related course that talks about basic quality control issues. So it really goes with both. Now, as I mentioned, before we get into developments, yes, the Senate did pass or didn't really pass this week. They actually just released. Whether it passes or not is still to be determined as this is being recorded. But they released this week their proposal on the healthcare plan. Significant changes they have made from the House version in the tax arena, principally the major change is going to be where the credits are going to look much more like the old Obamacare credits. Some changes in who qualifies, some changes in percentage of income. If you're older, a higher percentage of income will be required. Also, the level at which the credits end stops now at 350% of the poverty level, not 400%. But basically, it's very similar to the Obamacare credits in the structure of how it works. It no longer is a pure age-driven credit, which is what the House had. And I say no longer because let's remember, anything that passes has to be go back into and either the House has to adopt the Senate bill or we need to go to conference and figure out where things would stand. The Senate did not, as some discussion had been taking place during the month, there'd been consideration of basically continuing some of the taxes, most significantly the net invested income tax. The Senate bill eventually, the proposed bill at least, goes back to exactly what the House passed, which is the net invested income tax would go away as of the first of this year. All of the penalties for not providing insurance or for not having insurance, those would go away. So those particular tax penalties also would disappear in the bill. You want to keep your eye on this thing. Obviously, you know, the idea is that it's going to be negotiated. There's already, as of the time I'm recording this, four senators at this point. At this point, basically, we have five senators, I should say, who have said essentially that they can't vote for the bill as currently structured. So we'll have to see if, you know, what they do, if that's a negotiating ploy, who actually votes for it in the end. Remember, mechanically, the Republicans, assuming no Democrats vote for it, which I think is a very safe assumption, they really need to keep everybody, you know, that if they lose three senators, it fails. So if they lose three Republican senators, it fails. Therefore, you know, obviously those five are going to be talked to. And they are going to be asked what they need to get in order to change their mind. So keep your eyes open. Probably if something passes the Senate, the odds are it will be modified from what we see right now, because effectively we already have five senators on the record as saying what we have right now they're not going to vote for. So, you know, keep your eyes on the changes this week and watch what comes up. And if we do get a final bill, if we do actually get a final bill, we actually get something both the House and Senate are going to pass, at that point, expect that we'll have a deep dive on what exactly are the tax-related issues in the bill. For now, just kind of keep your eye on what's going on, because obviously we're in a changing situation. This is the first announcement this week, or the first development this week, comes from IRS News Release IR 2017-111, which was issued on June the 23rd. That particular press release, which came out, it was titled on the website, Security Summit Warns of New Phishing Email Targeting Tax Pros. This particular target is kind of interesting. It's a new way of going, and it brings up a reason we have to be aware of. The phishing email is being sent out to tax professionals posing as being from a professional continuing education provider. One thing you have to understand about the email system for the internet, it was never designed for security, and it does not actually check to make sure that the from address in an email that is being submitted to your system is actually coming from the party that's in the from address. In many cases, it is incredibly easy to spoof. In fact, very easy to change that from to read from anybody. So as I would note, it would be not that difficult for me to pose as sending an email from any of you listening to this particular broadcast. I could make it appear it comes from that. Only in very limited situations where you have true end-to-end security on the email, which is very rare because our systems for doing it right now are very difficult to make work properly. But unless there's true end-to-end security, it's essentially you have to always remember that that from address can be totally spoofed. It's also very easy to design an email that looks like an email that is normally sent by an organization, because all of those graphics and all those other things that are in email are very easy to grab from the websites. You've got to make them available, because otherwise, you know, in legitimate emails, they wouldn't be seen. So one problem that we have is these guys have figured out, why don't we just send emails to CPAs, EAs, attorneys, claiming to be from an educational organization. Now, this could be an organization like your State Society of CPAs. It could be an organization like us here at the Lascalzo Institute. It could be one of our sister companies. that does continuing education. It could be the AICPA. They can fake anybody. And it says, oh, we've got a problem. In a particular email that's being sent out now, the only catch right now is the wording is very stilted. And I would say it suggests it was written by somebody for whom English was not the first language. And that gives it a little bit of a, you know, you might pick it up. The catch is, doesn't take much work for them to find somebody who actually can write an English email that makes sense, you know, clean that up, and then it won't be so obvious. But in this case, it says, in our database, there is a failure. We need it, your information about your account. Okay, a little stilted sentence, but that's not that tough to fix if they wanted to. In addition, we need a photo of the driver's license. Send all data to the letter. Okay, yeah. Obviously, I think somebody wrote an email here and ran it through a translator because doesn't make a lot of sense, but nevertheless, please do it as soon as possible. This will help us to revive the account. Yeah, it seriously sounds like something that was written in one language and then thrown at something like Google Translate, and you get this type of stilted translation back. But nevertheless, you read quickly, you say, okay, I got a problem. I've got to do this. It wants to know company name, your e-services from the IRS username. Now, why any of us in continuing education would need that is open to question. Actually, we would never need that. That should be a good clue. Your password in your e-service account. That's also something we really shouldn't need. Your PIN, your CAF number. Oh, the answers to the secret questions to reset your mail account. That ought to be good. Your EIN number for organization, your business name, owner and principal's name, owner's principal's date of birth, owner's principal's social security number, your prior year's AGI and your mother's maiden name. Hopefully nobody will fall for that particular one, you know, asking for that type of personal and professional information. But it's not that difficult to imagine a later, more sophisticated attack that would ask for things that aren't so obviously wrong. You know, always, always, always be very, very careful about sending information to any in response to any email. The real thing you should do, if you ever receive an email from a state society, AICPA, or any of us education providers, if there really is a problem with your account, the best thing you should do is go directly to our website, not by clicking the link in the email. Again, it is trivial for me to take that link and send it anywhere. I don't care what the email says, do not click the link. Go back to your browser and type in HTTP, you know, maybe for the Arizona Society of CPAs, ASCPA.com, for Lascalzo, Lascalzo.com. And again, I really have no idea why we would want to know this from you. But nevertheless, if somebody tells you that we do, then go ahead and go there. It could be from a provider, you know, any other provider that's out there for email. But just go to that website. If any of us have problems with you and we need information on your account, if you log into your regular account on that website, you will be able to find out what's missing. And if you really do need to rebuild your account, you'll be able to do it there too. Don't ever click on the link of the email. Now, the IRS has information for those who have fallen victim, and the only warning I've got here is, unfortunately, it doesn't quite go far enough. The IRS says if you received or fell victim to the scam email, they want you to forward a copy to phishing@irs.gov. Okay, well, that's good. They're trying to figure out where it's coming from. If you disclose any information, contact eServices Help Desk. If you disclose information that taxpayer data was stolen, contact your local stakeholder liaison. I got even better news for you. If you actually gave up that information, that's given people access to a lot of client data that may be accessible by having that information that you have. If in fact that information has gotten loose, almost all but, as I recall today, three states require you to notify all affected parties. By the way, all affected parties can be broader than just your clients. Let's say that you do W-2s for one of your clients, you know, has a business. All of their employees' confidential information is going to be available somewhere in your systems. If you really get taken all the way and expose everything, you're probably going to notify all those people too. And yeah, it's not nice. There is huge potential liability. So basically, you got to be very, 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 very careful responding or working with any emails. You just cannot accept them at face value. I'm sorry, life's tough. You can whine about that not being fair and you shouldn't have to do it. But if you do it, you are going to be in trouble, and it's an extraordinarily expensive problem to fix if you get taken by it. Okay. Next up, we're going to talk about an IRS ruling on a C corporation that wants to turn to S. This is private letter ruling 2017-25022 issued on June the 23rd. Now, this was an S corporation, and you have to remember with a C corporation that wanted to turn S. Now, there's a little hitch with them. If you're a C corporation and you make an S election, in addition to the built-in gains tax issues you're going to run into, you've got a second problem if you have any accumulated earnings and profits, which you will have gathered from a C. You cannot create accumulated earnings and profits while you're an S corp unless you merge with a C corp. You have to get touched by a C in some way. But if you have accumulated earnings and profits and you have 3 years of excess passive income, then your S status is terminated. By the way, you also owe a tax for those 3 years. That you can get out of if you wonder where you didn't have E&P. You cannot get out of losing your status without IRS permission if you have that. Now, the problem here is passive income under this definition is not the same as passive income under the rules that apply to Section 469. Rather, this looks at, you know, a different set of issues. However, rentals are actually included in both. But if your rental arises from, and in this bigger case, the regular conduct of a trade or business, then it doesn't count as passive income for this purpose. It'll still be passive income, almost certainly, unless you're a real estate professional, for purposes of the 469 rules, but not for this. In this case, we had a C corporation that owned a rental building, that owned rental property. It's going to become an S corp. In fact, its principal business was, you know, handling these rentals. This corporation performed a number of services. And if you read the write-up that we have this week available for download on our website, you know, at currentfulltaxdevelopments.com on the audio and video weekly updates, if you download our description, we'll give you the information about everything that this company was doing. It's quite a bit of activities that it took care of. You know, it would do those services, it'd do various issues. It would pay, also had significant expenses that were incurred with regard to this rental. Based on those facts, the IRS ruled that this rental, as long as those facts were correct, would not be considered to be passive income. That is, it would arise from the active conduct of a trade or business of renting real estate, and as such, would not be subject to this particular treatment as passive income. One key, the catch is because of this nature, especially when you have a corporation like this, a C corp like this converting, we see in many cases, people do go for private letter rulings just to lock this down. Because again, if you're wrong, after 3 years, you lose your S status. If you're not aware of this rule and you have anything that is elected S from C in the past, you want to go back and check this. In addition to rentals, the other quote passive items are items that are specifically not treated as passive income under the standard 469 rule. Things like dividends, interest, are considered passive income for this purpose. So you've got to be careful. Too often people say, oh, I can't have excess passive income because all we have is interest income and dividends. No, for this purpose, that is passive income. And that's what causes us some confusion. Next up, we have a chief counsel advice 2017-24025 issued on June the 16th. And this deals with the question of the payroll tax liabilities of a company that hired a PEO to handle its payroll. This particular company had hired an outside PEO, professional employer organization, to basically take care of its employees. PEO is kind of like, you know, a somewhat, you know, beefed up employee leasing organization. In fact, that's what most employee leasing organizations call themselves these days, is professional employee organizations. And this particular issue, they have all the employees, they issue the payroll checks, they therefore take care of the payroll taxes, they issue W-2s. Nevertheless, all the real control of these people remains with the company. You know, the company retains the right to hire and fire everybody. The company controls what they do. So the company is actually their common law employer. Now, under this arrangement, because they're taking care of everything, when they pay payroll, you know, basically they pay payroll taxes are due. What they go back to the company that hired them and that company gives them the money to pay the payroll taxes. That's the way it works. Well, the problem in this case is, what happens if the PEO takes the money from you but doesn't send it to the IRS? Well, that's a problem because, remember, we have liability for those taxes. And in this case, the question became, was the company on the hook for these payments? Now, the company agreed they were the common law employer, but they attempted to avoid responsibility by saying 3401D of the Internal Revenue Code shifts responsibility. And what they're looking at is that D1, essentially, the person, if the person for whom the services were performed does not have control of payment of the wages for such services, the term employer means a person having control of payment of the wages. The company said, well, these guys actually issue the checks to the employees. They're the ones that actually make the payments. They have control of the wages. The IRS disagreed. The IRS said, no, that's always been interpreted by the courts as legal control. They went back, they looked at a couple of cases. In the case of Winstead versus United States from 1997 in the Fourth Circuit, there, Winstead had land owned by the sharecropper, or had land, and it's farmed by sharecroppers. The sharecroppers had no money to pay the hired help until the crop came in. So in that case, Winstead would actually pay the wages for them, and Winstead paid the payroll taxes. In that case, the court found that really Winstead was the one in control of payment of the wages. But conversely, they took a look at the case of INRI Earth Movers, which was a bankruptcy case in 1996 from Florida. There, it's much more like this. Pursuant to the contract, Earth Movers leased off its employees from Staff Leasing. The employees were under direction and control of Earth Movers, but Sunshine Staff Leasing was responsible for paying the taxes. But Earth Movers always sent the money in. They're saying, look, Earth Movers says, this person's on my payroll. Earth Movers gives them the money to pay the payroll. And in fact, the Staff Leasing company doesn't have to pay payroll unless the money comes in from the employer. They're saying in that case, really, the party who has control of payment of wages is still the company that hired the leasing company. For that reason, the IRS concluded in this case that the company in this particular exam that was being examined right now, or basically was trying to be, they're trying to collect the payroll taxes from them, they're still liable, because they really weren't in control of the payment of wages. The fact they didn't check to make sure that the payroll taxes were being paid is just tough luck. That's a responsibility. This issue is the reason why Congress added a couple of years ago, and what we're just now seeing starting to come out, the ability to become a certified professional employer organization. Now, you have to be a certified PEO, so they have to apply for and obtain that status, and there are still additional requirements that have to be met for the certified PEO status to work. For an employer, it has to be 75% of the employees at the site. We also have to have the CPEO and the company agree they're in a CPEO arrangement. But that was meant to avoid these sorts of problems. Now, most likely, this particular PEO would have failed to be a certified PEO because they have to get a bond, they need an audited financial, and obviously, the problem is going to be if they don't pay the payroll taxes, the bonding company has to pay up. Odds are they're not going to be around very long as a certified PEO if they're not doing that stuff. The audits are going to fail. The bonding company is going to fall apart. When they get to the quarterly reports they have to file, it's going to be clear they haven't made the payments, and then they'll be out. But just be very careful. If you are using a leasing company, remember that you are on the hook for the taxes if the leasing company doesn't pay. Next up, hey, remember that we lost the ability to get P-10s? Okay, well, we now have, the IRS has gone back now to issuing P-10s. Following the Steele case from the U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia, the IRS shut down the Preparer Tax Identification Number system entirely. Steele said they could require P-10s, but Steele said they couldn't charge for them. Well, the IRS has now started reissuing P-10s, but they did that as of June the 21st. If you need a P-10, you can now get one. You can get one renewed. But they did not guarantee you will not be charged later for this if they go back to court and they win on appeal. They also issued a set of frequently asked questions. They remind you in the Q&As that you are required to have a P-10. The case did not say no P-10 is required. You must have a P-10 in order to prepare tax returns for compensation. That's mandatory. You must get the P-10 issued. Okay. Are we going to get refunds? The IRS says we're looking at that. In essence, if in fact, they decide to appeal the case, the answer is probably no until the appeals are heard. If they don't appeal the case, then you're going to have to look a little differently. Now, the IRS does say that if they do this, they do not want you to file a claim for refund right now. The information about any claims, you should go to the P-10 class action administrator, which is, remember, this was a class action suit, at p10classaction.com to find out information about what, if anything, you could do, what, if anything, you may want to do if you want to get out of the class action and file a separate claim. We're going to see about this. They also made very clear that you might have to pay for it later. We don't know. The P-10 helpline is reopening, and a P-10 is still required to file a tax return, be an enrolled agent, or schedule an appointment for the special enrollment exam. All of those things are still required. So basically, the IRS is back to issuing P-10s, but may actually discover that, you might have to pay for one if you get one renewed right now. So I wouldn't rush in to do it. First thing is you probably can't renew because you're good through the end of the year at this point. Secondly, just because we get to the end of the year, you renew under this free one, don't be surprised if the IRS wins on appeal sometime in May next year that you're suddenly faced with a bill or your P-10 is going to be yanked. So, keep your eye on this. And as I said, when it first came out, I wouldn't go spend all my refund money at the same place right away, at least not until the IRS decides they're not going to appeal this case. And even then, expect it to take a while to get your money. Finally, let's take a look at the Zintel Construction versus Commissioner case. This is TC Memo 2017-119, issued on June the 19th. In this case, the taxpayer had asked for an offer in compromise on payroll taxes. Now, they prepared their offer. They, talked about the liquidation value of the company, and they made an offer of $1 million on what's unpaid payroll taxes of somewhere just over $6 million. So bottom line, interest, tax, interest penalties, et cetera, over $6.5 million was sitting outstanding. Now the settlement officer looked at that and said, well, I look at the Internal Revenue Manual, and in order to consider this, since this is an operating business, I need to consider your going concern value. And so the company, in responding, provided a going concern value, right, to them. The going concern value that was provided to them after we got all this done was essentially that the going concern effectively was going to be somewhere around $2,100,000. But they made a key issue of that, saying that, the only reason this thing has positive value at the moment is because of accounts receivable and going concern. If you actually forced it to shut down and liquidate, they decided that a liquidation value for the company, it would be in the hole nearly $4 million. So essentially, IRS, you couldn't get paid. Most of your liability would remain unpaid. Well, the settlement officer said, but wait, you got a value of $2,100,000. Well, that included taking into account this payroll tax liability. I'm going to add that back. Now, the liability he took into account was about $4 million because they didn't treat any of the penalties on the liability. That was included in the valuation. So basically $4 million. So he added back four. So the total value is $6 million some, and said, you need to resubmit your OIC, giving me, because I'm going to say that my effective or reasonable collection potential is $4,190,000, which is 80% of what he determined the going concern value was. The taxpayer said, well, wait a minute. First thing is, we don't think that going concern value should be considered if you're talking about an offer made by the company as opposed by owners of the company. Because, the company is, the company's entity by itself. And there we're just looking at the assets of the company, and we're not worried about going concern value. The tax court said, well, no, here, problem. The Internal Revenue Manual, generally the IRS is deemed to act reasonably in accepting an OIC if they act in accordance with the Internal Revenue Manual, because the IRS, the tax court, can only override their decision if there is an abuse of discretion. And they said, following Internal Revenue Manual, this is allowed. But they said, IRS, we don't think you were correct in adding back the payroll taxes. They're saying, we understand that basically, you know, it kind of seems ridiculous to reduce the value by the payroll taxes in determining how much of the payroll taxes can be paid. But they said, going concern looks what an outside buyer would pay for the company as it stands. An outside buyer would take that into account. So, you know, so we're saying, look, per your rules, there's nothing that allows you to add that back. So you have to reduce that down to the $2,000,001. Now, the court did say, we're sending it back to you for reconsideration. We are not saying the $1 million offer is reasonable. In fact, presumably, it's not reasonable because 80% of $2 million is not a million. But they're saying, but you cannot simply reject it by saying it has to be at least $4 million, because that's not reasonable. That is an abuse of discretion. Well, it's summer, and coming up here shortly, we're going to have the 4th of July. You know, happy 4th of July time. And hey, here in Phoenix, we're actually going to cool down to an actually frigid 109 later this week. That ought to be great. Today, when I'm recording this on Sunday, it's going to be only 115, which is cooler than 122. We'll accept that. But you want to go ahead. If you want to go ahead and stay cool and go inside and take your CPE, go ahead and take a look at what your state society has coming up here for continuing education. Most state societies have a number of courses running here through the end of June. They'll also have some, probably not on the 4th of July, but coming up shortly after that. So take a look through June, July, August. Watch your continuing education. Remember, we are definitely expecting there to be, well, I shouldn't say expecting, there may very well be a health care bill finally coming out that has tax implications that you're going to be expected to be up to speed on. We are told, according to the Speaker of the House, that they want to do comprehensive tax reform before the end of the year. He kind of promised it by then again. So keep your eyes open. There could be a lot of developments. Your state societies are going to be responding to that. Keep your eyes open. Sign up for live CPE from there. The big advantage of live CPE is we can actually talk about something that happened the day before, because that's one of the things, those of us who lecture in these areas, we got to keep up on that stuff. So, you know, consider the advantages of going down there and being in a live course with your state society. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments, brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute for the week of the 26th. In Phoenix, I would love for it to be January, but unfortunately, it is June. You can catch our daily updates on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF with articles with all today's topics on the weekly updates page. You can send any questions or comments to me, my email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'll be at edzollers. Next week, well, after you guys probably get back from 4th of July and, you know, your parties and whatever you're doing there, we will be able to give you an update on what's going on this week in the area of taxes. We also may have, if the Senate actually passes a bill, we might have a health care bill to discuss, at least health care version number 2 to play with, and maybe even some idea of where we'd go in conference. If so, we'll discuss it. Keep track, wait for all of that coming up next week on Current Federal Tax Developments.